Welcome to the Passive House podcast, brought to you by Passive House Accelerator, a catalyst for zero carbon building. For news, inspiration, and connections from all flavors of Passive House, check out passivehouseaccelerator.com. Sign up to receive regular updates about events, get your technical questions answered, and contribute to the community forum. There's loads of free information for experienced professionals and people just starting out on their Passive House journey. We hope to see you at one of our construction tech or weekly global Passive House showcase webinars. In the meantime, here's this week's Passive House podcast. Well, welcome back to another episode of the Passive House podcast. I'm Matthew Cutler-Welsh, coming to you from Auckland.
And I'm Zach Semke, coming to you from Seattle.
Freshly back from New York in Seattle, Zach. How was New York?
It was great. It was so fun. I was in New York for FiesCon, formerly known as the North American Passive House Conference, put on by Fies. And we were in Tarrytown, which is about an hour, maybe 45 minutes north of New York City in the Hudson Valley. And it was amazing. It was so, you know, it's so great to be with people, which we heard so many times that it became cliche, but it's just a big deal. You know, we're social beings. So it's nice to
getting back to, in a crowd of 400 people.
That's right.
Sellout crowd.
It was a sellout crowd. Yep. And it was super fun. Lots of great presentations. Also, unveiling of Fies's new branding and a little bit of a dive into their suite of certifications. And some of the stuff I think came out in the conversation with Katrin on the podcast. But they have a new beautiful website that's about to be launched, and all sorts of great developments happening for Fies, which is really cool to see.
Yeah, if you haven't checked that out, then definitely check out our previous episode when we had your conversation with Katrin, which was great. It was just a really good update of where Fies is at and this, you know, this the ongoing science behind Passive House and the growth and interest and applicability of that. It's really good stuff. You managed to catch up with some other people while you're there. So are we going to be bringing out some other?
Yeah, I did, I think, 15 interviews. So for short interviews for bonus podcast episodes that we'll roll out over the next month or so, something like that. Really, really fun conversations. And it's a really kind of odd way to experience a conference. So I was able to experience all of the plenary sessions where everyone was together. But then for all of the breakout sessions, I was just focused on doing interviews with people. But it's also a real privilege because you get this concentrated time where you can learn a lot about people's career and also the key insights that they're sharing in their presentations. So it was fun.
Nice.
Yeah.
Very good. Well, we've got some more key insights from a previous guest on the show today, a pretty high profile guest. Yeah. Well, before we get into that, let's thank some of our sponsors.
Yeah, absolutely. So everything we do at the Accelerator comes thanks to support from our sponsors. So I want to give a big thank you to our founding sponsors, 475 High Performance Building Supply, Baxt Ingwe Architects, Glavel Foam Glass Gravel, Minotaur All-in-One HVAC and Dehumidification Units, Mitsubishi Electric Train HVAC US, Partel, RDH Building Science, Rockwell North America, Stocorp, and Zola Windows. Our champion sponsors are Icon Windows and Doors and SIGA, and our stakeholder partner is NYSERDA, the New York State Energy Research and Development Authority. So thank you, sponsors.
Thank you very much. Diana Urge-Vorsatz. She is a friend of the show. She was on episode 12 with a great interview that you did, Zach. And she's also been a keynote speaker and a guest around the world for a number of years. I realized that she was actually here in New Zealand in 2018 doing some presentations at Otago University and talking about energy and how well placed. I mean, that one of her main themes, I think, is just how well placed the building industry is to make a substantial change and really do more than our fair share to address climate change. So, it's great to get her back on the show. You had her on as a guest, episode 12. And I was really keen on getting someone who was involved in the IPCC back on the show ever since the report came out in August of this year, which was picked up by mainstream media. And it really highlighted that things are getting critical and we have a choice. And that's really the I think the key messages that came out. Obviously, there's a huge amount of detail in that, but it basically said things are going to change, but there is a window of opportunity for us to make a significant improvement on the likely outcomes and the trajectory, and that it's up to us as a planet, basically, and as humanity, as what we do with this information now. Yeah. So Working Group 3 of the IPCC, it's a huge and important role, and she's very well qualified for that role with her vast experience working in this area. And, it was really good to catch up with her and talk about a little bit about her journey of how she got into that position, but also where to from here for the building industry and, like I said, our contribution to climate change. So here he is. Here is my chat with Diana. Thank you, Diana, for joining us again on the Passive House podcast. It's a real pleasure.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
Be able to speak to you. I want to go back in time a little bit because we jumped in last time talking about some of the great work that you had been involved in and a recent report put out basically emphasizing the capability that the building sector already has. But I want to know a little bit about you. How did you get into this field in the first place? You grew up and first studied in Hungary, but then eventually found yourself across at in the US. How did you get to the IPCC?
Yes, well, these are all very interesting stories. So when I was doing my PhD at the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory in the US, then I was working with Evan Mills, who at that time was working on one of the IPCC reports. He was, I think he was a review editor or something, but he was telling me so enthusiastically about the IPCC that I thought, that's something for me. So when I got back to Hungary after my PhD, then I just ran over the person who was at that time the IPCC focal point, and I was just telling him about my dream that I would really love to work within the IPCC. So one day I just got a text message and said, well, actually, now are the nominations. Do you want to get nominated? I said, well, sure. I was really young and I really didn't expect anything. And one day I get a phone call, which the phone call said that, Diana, you were nominated only as a lead author, but we would really like to offer you a coordinating lead author role. Would you take it? Are you ready? And I said, well, of course, yeah. I was more than happy. And it was very interesting because that was to lead the buildings chapter in the fourth assessment report. So that really got me into already before I was working with buildings, but much more on appliances and electricity, because I did my PhD on lighting energy efficiency. So I was much more involved in the plug load related efficiency. So when I was working on the fourth assessment report, there was this guy who was an author on my chapter team, Danny Harvey, and he kept saying that, well, we can have with buildings 80% savings, energy savings and so on. Everybody said, is this guy nuts? How could we have 80% energy savings? And I was also working at Lawrence Berkeley, and I was used to, you know, working on 30% energy savings as a big number. And 80% really did seem like, okay, well, he's a bit lunatic. So, but he kept bringing the evidence that actually there are more and more buildings which really are achieving 80 to 90% energy savings. And so that got me really interested in this whole area. And and that got me involved with the Passive House community. And I'm really fortunate because ever since then, I do believe that from all the solutions, and now I work with a very, very broad range of different solutions because I, as a vice chair in IPCC, I oversee the work of all three working groups and get involved in the detail of all the different chapters and different work pieces of work. But I do believe that buildings do have the biggest and most attractive and most beneficial solutions for climate change.
So that evidence that was being presented, was that essentially Passive House?
Well, at that time, he didn't really call it Passive House. He just showed a lot of different buildings where a systemic approach to retrofits or new building design did achieve these levels.
Right.
So I guess it was later that I think he also was aware of the Passive House concept, but he also, and at that time, he also very much pushed the concept of integrated design. So yep. The concept that you really work with all the participants of the planning process and all the and that the plumbers and the electricians should be at the design table already and be involved throughout the whole process and then later on also during the operation of the building. So the more system thinking.
Yep.
And that was also attractive. But certainly at that time, we were already covering Passive House to some extent, yes.
How does being in a role at the IPCC work? Because you have other roles at the same time, right? You're still an academic, you're still at a university. So are you juggling multiple roles at once?
Yes, absolutely. That's the really tough challenge about this, that working with the IPCC is actually a voluntary job. So it's your most expensive hobby you ever had.
Wow. Is that true for all of the authors there?
Yes, for everyone in the IPCC, except co-chairs and the chair, because they are often paid by the government. But I'm actually not convinced necessarily that the developing country co-chairs are necessarily paid by the government. So it's usually the employers who kind of tolerate that we also do these other things at the same time, and in exchange of the prestige that we bring to the institution.
Yeah.
And if they can, if they want to offer us some teaching credits or other things. Now, I got lucky because I was on basically maternity or parental leave or different of these structures all through this time. And so I did it as my hobby during my motherhood. So that fit well because this is what I can do from home and I can do at my own pace and when I have time.
But like you say, I guess it looks good for your Central European University. I guess it looks good for them to have people like yourself and be able to say, hey, our staff is contributing to IPCC reports and being an author and being a facilitator there as well. There are so many, when you look at these reports, firstly, let's step back a little bit. IPCC is not just a small group of people writing one report, is it? Was it report number 6 now of the big report? But can you tell us a little bit how that report is broken down into different sections and how different people collaborate for those different sections?
Absolutely. So as you say, the IPCC is actually the government and they ask for reports. The main work of the IPCC are what you just mentioned, the so-called assessment reports, which we do every 6 to 7 years. And what we are producing now is the 6th of such a report series, because it's a series of reports. Normally, this has 3 parts, Working Group 1 produces the science basis of climate change, the physical science basis. Working Group 2 discusses impact and adaptation. The report is due to come out in February. And the third group works on mitigation. Mm-hmm. And our report is going to come out in April. And then
that's your group that you're involved in is the third group, right?
Exactly. Right. Exactly. And then there is also a synthesis report, which summarizes all three and tries to integrate the findings of the three. And just after the recording of this podcast, I'm going back to lead a write shop on how we think about the summary for policymakers of the synthesis report. So the synthesis of the synthesis of the synthesis, basically. And it's really fascinating to work together with these leading scientists and how when we have to say, okay, so how can we say all of this unbelievable amount of knowledge in just a couple of sentences, which is well-founded, but still brings an important message across?
I guess that's a challenge because you've got literally a global audience. You've got huge amount of scientific data and input and some of the best minds in the world, but you still have at most 10 to 30 seconds in the news slots to get a headline across and make it hit, because that's your target is the world news, right? And I think the report that came out from the first working group in August this year did achieve that, because it had some pretty big statements, right?
Absolutely. But in fact, we are very careful that we do not target the media. Our most important audience, or in fact, almost the only audience, is the policymakers and decision makers. Right. Our reports are for the policymakers, especially the summaries for policymakers. Nevertheless, of course, we really welcome the media taking it over. So we, in this cycle, and already towards the end of the last one, but especially in this cycle, we really try to focus. So we do have communications experts, more communications experts hired by IPCC, and there is a strong communication team which works with the authors, when we get interviewed, how to try to translate this. Because what, as a scientist, we really want to avoid is being sensationalist. So we can't overstate anything. We really need to be precise. We are the world authorities. And in fact, we have very strong instructions not to deviate from the agreed text. So all we can say is what all the authors agreed to, and then all the governments agreed to. So if we wear the IPCC's hat in front of the media or anywhere, we actually cannot really add our own views. Only we have to really stick to the reports and the science. But why we need these communications experts is that very often scientists cannot really be very clear. We are too jargony, we are too abstract, we are too complex, we are too scientific, and in the end, it's not accessible by the policymakers. It doesn't really mean anything for the average person. So I think what we are now becoming much better at is trying to make our work more accessible and more actionable. And I think that made a universe of a difference, because we do see that in this cycle, even a 1.5-degree report, which was a special report. So you mentioned already the assessment report, but we also do publish in each cycle, each assessment report cycle, one or two, this cycle, three special reports. One of the special reports was on 1.5 degrees of global warming. And that report got enormous media coverage. And that was, I believe, because we learned much more how to communicate well. But it was quite interesting that the report itself didn't have anything scary, because it was mostly about the difference between 1.5 to 2 degrees of global warming. Still, it came through in the media as doomsday scenario and that it's end of the world. So it's quite interesting how actually the world reads our reports and what they read out of it. On the other hand, I think that the report that came out in August, even I was in tears when I was in the negotiations for the summary for policymakers and on some of the details. You know, I did get pretty depressed on some. So that report is, I think, really, it was how the UN Secretary General titled it was Code Red for Humanity, and I fully agree.
Well, that's a bit of a headline catcher right there. And I'm, from what I recall, and just bringing up some of the summary points now, it discusses some different pathways, some potential options, and that they're happening already. Things have the potential to get a lot worse, but there are some possible futures, some viable futures that we have to avoid the very worst scenarios from happening. So I think it was that mixture of this is real, it could be really, really bad, but we still have a window that we need to really start taking action. So I think it provided that sort of wake-up call, but also with a small bit of hope of saying, yeah, we do have the ability to fix this.
I think it's much more than a small window of hope. Because
good. That's good to hear.
Absolutely, because yes, it did say, which was the bad news part of it very much, that in fact there are many of these processes which we already started and which will not stop for hundreds and even thousands of years, even if tomorrow we don't start our engines, no engines will start anymore, or not a molecule of carbon dioxide is emitted anymore, even then we already have these really scary processes. But the important news was that there's a huge difference between 1.5 degrees of warming and 5 degrees warming. And we still can hold this at 1.5 degrees warming. We do have still the ability to stay there. So I think that's really good news, because I think everybody was expecting that the report will say this boat is gone.
Yeah.
But it didn't say that. Okay, it didn't say that, oh, it's easy, piece of cake. No, it did say that unless there are rapid and immediate and major pervasive changes, that scenario, that future will be gone. But it said that theoretically we still can get there. And I think that was an important message.
So this was from Working Group 1, and you're, like I said, you're on Working Group 3. So how does this feed into your work, or what can we expect from the Working Group 3 stuff, which you're working on now? And is that due for release next year?
Yes, it's due in April. So what the Working Group 3 report will tell us is how actually we can get and still keep it at 1.5 degrees or two, or so what should we do and what are our options? No, we will never say what should we do, because the IPCC will never prescribe anything. We are policy relevant, but not policy prescriptive. But we will give the different menus of options and also the different impacts of those menus of options. So what the costs are, what if we don't do these, what if we wait longer? So it will be a comprehensive assessment of what we can do about this, but not in terms of adapting to the impact or impacts, but strictly about to prevent climate change or to mitigate.
And last time you spoke with Zach on this podcast and in some other various conferences that you've presented at, a lot of that's been about retrofitting. You've talked about net zero energy as opposed to net zero carbon because of that focus on avoiding going down the track of offsets. Has anything changed in the last little while, or is it just those same sort of messages that we need to push out to the wider industry?
I think the message is the same, but it's got much stronger. Mm-hmm. For example, in the last report that came out in August that we are just discussing, for example, one of the important messages say that stabilize climate change at any level, that requires us going to net zero carbon dioxide emissions, at least And we have to also tackle the other gases. But that's, I think, a very powerful message. That means that even if we want to stabilize the climate at 3, 4, 5, 6, 10 degrees, we still need to go to net zero. So that means that net zero is no option anymore. We just have to get to net zero, because otherwise humanity will go extinct. I mean, 10 degrees of climate change, we just won't be able to stand. So we have to get to net zero. So that's one. But it also had another very interesting message, which pointed that the higher the temperature, so the more, the further down we are with the warming, the less effective any of our capturing is going to be, and the less effective any of our offsets going to be. So, and the less both the ocean and land, the ability of the ocean and land, the ability of the ocean and land will be less and less in order to capture some of the carbon that we emit. Because presently, the majority of the carbon dioxide that we emit is actually taken up by our land and our ocean. But this is going to diminish significantly. That also means the reverse. It means that if we want to take it out, it's going to be less and less effective. So that's, I believe these are really important messages together, because that basically means, and the IPCC didn't say that, but to me, if you think through this, that basically means that basically we all should take care of our own emissions, and everybody should kind of be responsible for their own net zero emissions. And I don't mean each individual person, but for example, each sector should try to become net zero themselves, because the problem is that offsets are working less and less. And the problem with the approach that now we are taking, that, okay, well, we just keep doing what we're doing, we'll just electrify everything, or those end uses that we can't electrify, we'll just hydrogenize and we'll just produce all this clean hydrogen and we'll be just fine. Well, actually, it turns out that there is no way we can actually do this in time we can expand our clean electricity and clear hydrogen capacity by so much that we would electrify all of aviation, all of vehicle transport, all of heating, all of industrial processes. If we try to electrify all of this, we would have to expand our current electricity producing capacity by so much that there is absolutely no way we can achieve that within the time frame that we have to go there. Let's see, just for example, the current energy crisis. That's a bit also about our lack of energy or shortage of energy capacities. So that places an even bigger emphasis on demand side reductions and on energy efficiency and on, especially on the building sector, which is such a big user or end user of, for example, clean electricity, that if the building sector can kind of try to supply its own energy and satisfy its own needs, then we can leave the power plants for supplying all the other needs that we don't have good solutions for. For aviation, we don't have any good solutions, like in buildings.
Yeah.
And there are many other industrial processes and concrete and so on. We don't have many other options. So that's why it's really crucial that the building sector should try as much as possible to become net zero on their own, rather than just having to buy zero carbon electricity. Let's try to actually supply our own energy.
Because globally, I think it's agreed now that buildings contribute somewhere around 40%, about 39% globally. It's less here where I am in New Zealand because of various factors. We're about 20% here, partly because we have dams for our electricity and we have lots of cows and lots of transport because we're a long, skinny island. But it's the same concept that buildings, I think you emphasize this, that the buildings have the ability to change much more effectively than, say, aeroplanes or cars to a zero emission, zero energy. And I think last time you mentioned the potentially even going further, you know, we could have buildings that are positive energy and actually supplying on a personal level, that could be as simple as having an electric car that is being charged by solar panels on your roof. And if you've got an efficient enough envelope where you're not using all of that energy, you've got some left over for the car. So, yeah, efficiency first, I guess, is the underlying message there. And you also talked a lot about the need for us to reuse what's already built, and that real importance and the huge challenge of doing retrofits. And I think you're a big advocate for deep retrofits instead of just tinkering around the edges.
Absolutely. And I'm very proud because our research on my new campus in Vienna is just going to get a big straight prize in Austria next tomorrow, actually.
Right.
Because it's in recognition of the novelty of how national monument and monument, highly protected national monument, can also become basically a power plant, the power plant of the 21st century, while observing and respecting to the utmost level the national heritage, the historic heritage level, and the cultural heritage aspects. So that's, and what is really important, that this research also showed that, in fact, that retrofit will actually cost us less than the regular retrofit to turn this old historic hospital district into an energy positive district will actually cost less than if we just do a regular retrofit. Yeah. And the trick is, because of that, we won't need to upgrade and retrofit the district heating system, and these district solutions infrastructures are often very expensive and also have a lot of embodied energy and embodied carbon. But the point I want to make is just a very slight point on what you just mentioned, that you said that it's important that the envelope is very efficient. Well, in fact, the trick to net zero buildings and retrofits is not only the envelope. It's actually very much the internal use as well. So in this research, we took a year to understand the energy using behavior of the different occupants, and the only way how also this, and normally usually also other buildings, which are major energy users for office buildings or other similar big building schools and universities and so on, mm-hmm. they can become energy positive, is if you drastically reduce the energy demand. And also here and also in previous cases, we managed to reduce the electricity demand. And that does include heating and cooling, but that's a very small part of it. The entire energy demand by tenfold. So you need a 90% wow. reduction in all plug loads. And mm-hmm. that was possible through simply a good understanding of everything, of the coffee machines to the security systems and the elevator. So how people are using this and how to optimize this. And none involves telling people that you shouldn't do this or shouldn't do that, but simply optimizing everything to really the people's needs, tailoring everything to the people's needs. This is a lot of work, but it's a lot of brain work. It's not carbon yeah. intensive work. And as a result, you can reduce the energy demand by tenfold. And as a result, then you can supply your energy needs with the remaining locally produced power, which is not always that much. In your end of the world, perhaps it's more, but you need to understand that our region is pretty much more towards the north, and also it's often very cloudy. So it's fairly limited, but it's still feasible.
But it's still possible. So yeah, if it's possible in those locations, it's pretty much possible anywhere. You've got to go. Diana, really appreciate your time today, but also your just ongoing work, your enthusiasm, and all the people that you collaborate with and work on such important work. I'm really, really grateful that we have you as part of the Passive House community as well. So thank you for your input into the various conferences and continued interest in the work. It's a real pleasure and an honor to have this chance to chat.
Well, it was a real honor for me, and I really wish all of you the best of luck with your work, because I know that I only talk about this, but you actually do it. So you have to all be proud that you are actually saving the world while I'm only preaching about it.
And that was Diana Erger-Vorsatz, who is professor and director at the Center for Climate Change and Sustainable Energy Policy at the Central European University. And she is also the vice chair of Working Group 3 on the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And, second time she's been a guest on the show, and great to have her back with all of her knowledge and inspiration. It was a privilege to be able to speak with Diana, not just once, but twice on the show. Just really, I guess for me, it highlights the importance, the urgency of the situation. But like she said, that the window is not a tiny window. We do have some wiggle room, and we have the skills, we have the technology, and I think we just need to kind of get on with it.
Yeah, great interview, really well done, and I do feel so fortunate that Diana has been available to do another chat with us. If there's anybody in the world that we want to be able to, query about where things are with the severity of the climate crisis, and also the potential for buildings to be a powerful way to mitigate that crisis, it's Dr. Diana Erger-Vorsatz, right? I mean, she's got the expertise in terms of understanding the full breadth of the science, as well as the grounding in buildings, starting back from her work at Lawrence Berkeley Labs. So
yeah,
I felt really hopeful after listening to this interview. Because she shared how, the tears were coming to her, that she was experiencing tears during the process of that report that you mentioned, of creating that report that you mentioned in August. That got released in August, and feeling depressed, and that the Code Red for Humanity is really, a loud alarm bell. But at the same time, that we do have much more than a small window of hope. That we have that we do have a reasonable window, and that it was a surprise for a lot of people that this boat hadn't already left. That we still theoretically could limit warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius, and should do everything in our power to work to that end.
Yeah, that 1.5 degrees is interesting. I first came across that, I guess it was nearly 2 years, 2 years ago now, when our research association, Building Research Association New Zealand Brands, they got some great people looking at climate change stuff there. And at the time, I remember thinking, yeah, this is all well and good, but no one really cares that much about climate change here. They're just worried about the cost of building and the price of materials and the shortage of labor. But that's changed in that period of time. And I'm really grateful for the people who have done the local research, because they've really laid the groundwork in establishing where we are right now and where we need to get to. And I often hear this argument about New Zealand and the world stage, and that we're tiny, we're just 5 million people down in the South Pacific. What possible difference? It's all China's fault, this sort of thing, or it's all North America, because we're tiny compared to how much carbon and coal you guys are burning. And But if my argument to that is, if we had that outlook with things like the America's Cup, then we would be sailing little dinghies. we can compete on the world stage. We can show leadership, as anyone can. you know, whether you're a researcher in a university in Hungary or if you're designing passive houses in Melbourne or Auckland or in the middle of the US, you can have an influence. You can show people the way it can be done because that has this multiplier effect. So I don't think it's an size of any community is necessarily an excuse. But I also, what that research pointed out was that the current average New Zealand house consumes five times more, puts out five times more carbon than what would be required to stay below that 1.5. So if every house was built the same way that we currently build houses, we'd be at five times over the limit. And even some of our most efficient or quote unquote eco houses are still way over the mark. It's only when you get to passive house or the equivalent of that, where you achieve that 1.5, that benchmark. And it's a really, I can see the graph now in my mind showing those different scenarios and those different typologies and where they sit at that threshold. And it's really, really telling that just, you know, and then I think, wow, you know, 30 years ago when passive house started, some of the genesis of that was the original oil shock. But to think that it's become even more relevant now from a global energy perspective is quite staggering. And I guess the underlying truth of all that is science and physics, which is the expertise of people like Diana. So in some ways, it's not surprising that, oh, hey, it actually works.
Right. Well, and she shared that first when she was first hearing about the potential of buildings and hearing this number 80%, you know, reductions in energy use and being like, well, that's crazy. I mean, we were, you know, 30% seemed like a lot when she was at Lawrence Berkeley Labs, if I recall correctly.
Yep.
And I mean, that's the passive house is so transformative. So, and I mean, I'm paraphrasing, but I was really struck by that, her synthesis that of all the solutions available to the climate crisis, that buildings have the biggest and most attractive and most beneficial, are the most beneficial solutions for the problem. You know, that,
Buildings can even be energy positive. You know, that's a pretty exciting proposition. It's not just about doing less bad, but buildings could actually be a supplier of energy to your electric car, for example.
Right. And this also, this notion that that we should be aiming for making, for building, the building sector being kind of self-sufficient on energy. That was an interesting insight, a framing of it that was a little bit novel for me. So that we can, other power plants can then, so that power plants can then be focused on dealing with the more difficult to mitigate sectors of our economies.
So the
excitement around electrification, which I think is well founded, it's really important to stay grounded also in the reality that energy efficiency is a critically important piece of this puzzle, specifically with buildings.
Yeah, efficiency first. We can't generate our way out of reducing carbon. We need to reduce the demand side, which we could totally do without forfeiting any health or comfort outcomes. I'm really glad that Diana kind of schooled me and corrected me when I talked about communication and getting sort of headline statements.
Right. Yeah.
I've been thinking quite a lot about the communication of science recently, for other reasons. But it's very topical about, you know, how really good scientists get their message out to the public for the purpose of making change. And what Diana said was that they don't target media, they target policymakers. If their message happens to get picked up by media, then it's probably a really important message. And I think that's probably what happened this last August. But I think that's an interesting strategy from IPCC, that they're then audience is not Fox News or CNN or whoever, or BBC or whoever it is. It's policymakers who need to know what's going to make the difference over a period of time. And if that happens to make the news, then so be it. So I thought that was interesting. And there was one other point I can't remember what it was now. But anything else that dropped out for you?
Yeah. Well, related to that was the importance of communication specialists to help with crafting those messages. And I think one of the obvious things that you see when you look at these reports is the quality of the infographics that are being shared to help bring home the points that are being made. I still remember, I can't remember what they're called. They're basically ember sticks, or there's a term that community uses to describe the infographics that show the different kind of levels of severity based on a color code. So basically going from, I think, if a memory serves, like green and blue as fairly okay and good to, yellow and orange and red, and then like this deep purple, you know, scary colors.
Like how bad things are going to get.
Yeah. Well, the potential, hopefully not, but the potential of like, what does that mean, for 1.5 degrees versus 2 degrees? And what does that mean? So 1.5 degrees to 2 degrees for coral reefs and for, the Arctic sea ice, or, you know, any number of different key systems or ecosystems that we think about. To really drive home in a more kind of, visceral way or experiential way, what the difference that the critically important point, which is that every single, tenth of a degree matters a lot. And that, and that's, I think, a point that she talked about was that there's a huge difference between, and she was talking about a wider span, from 1.5 degrees warming to 5 degrees warming. And that we have a really great window to avoid the really severe warming if we are smart about it.
Yeah. I remember what the other thing was. I felt like I had a little Greta sitting on my shoulder. And I kind of wanted to raise the issue of the value of writing reports every few years. And is that an example of what Greta would call blah, blah, blah? Mm. And maybe Prince Charles would call just talking about talking. Mm-hmm. I didn't broach that directly with Diana, but I like to think that their research is really important and really informative. It's kind of up to us to translate that into action. I think it's really good to have informed, well-written reports and really good research. But if we just leave it there and say, that's interesting, and move on and carry doing what we do, then it is just blah, blah, blah. But a lot of this information points to the fact that we do have the ability, we have the technology, and particularly in the building sector, we have this huge potential to have an impact. So it is really up to us now what we do with this and use it to the best advantage that we have.
Definitely. And activists like Greta use these reports in their work. I mean, the 1.5 degrees special report that came out, I think, a year and a half ago or 2 years ago, that you both alluded to in the conversation, mentioned it, you know, was a key in elevating the conversation about the urgency of acting quickly. And this, you know, and there's been a lot of focus in the activist community around focusing around the year 2030. And this idea that we have this 10 years left to do, you know, to do something important.
2030 is not that far in the future anymore.
No, it's not.
It used to be like, you know, we're right out there.
Yeah. And I would say that there's a care and a sticking to the science and not wanting to sensationalize, or a commitment to not sensationalize, that I really respect from from Diana's work and the work of the scientists that are part of the IPCC. And activists are creative with with the way that they apply these reports. So that, you know, I think that in so that, you know, there's this, she mentioned the doomsday, there's kind of this doomsday interpretation of these reports from the media and from activists, which on an emotional level, I don't appreciate because, you know, we need to like operate and be functional human beings and not completely our hair on fire. But I understand from an activist point of view why you want to motivate, and we could motivate people to act, and we could have a debate about whether that's the way to motivate and whether it's more important to talk, you know, remind people about the potential for, you know, hopeful outcomes. But probably it needs to be kind of this whole ecosystem of emotions that we're going to be drawing from to motivate people to do stuff. And I guess this is a very long-winded way of saying that I think that the reports like this provide tools for all for communicators and activists to reach beyond the blah blah blah.
Yeah. Awesome. A lot, lots in there. Diana's pretty easy to follow. She's online. She's on LinkedIn, a lot of where her presentations have been made available as well on previous conferences and websites. So you can just search her up, and also get access to any of those reports from IPCC, you know, check them out. There's some good summary guides. You don't have to read the full report. So there's lots of really good stuff there that's really applicable to the building sector and the work of anyone involved with Passive House. So get stuck into that. And I'd love to get people's feedback as well. If you've got any thoughts on that and other topics, you want to be part of that debate, then send us an email or get in touch via Passive House Accelerator. Be great to hear from you. All right. What have we got events coming up, Zach?
So at the Accelerator, this coming week is a busy one. We have on Tuesday, Construction Tech Tuesday, which is Wednesday your time, we will be joined by Chris Magwood of the Endeavor Center, based in Canada. And Chris is a leading thinker around embodied carbon. So he'll be presenting about low-rise building as a climate solution, materials, strategies, tools, and costs for making real zero carbon buildings, and should be very thought provoking, particularly from a Passive House, you know, point of view about what's important: operational carbon, embodied carbon, both. Mm-hmm. How does it all work? So then on Wednesday for the showcase, so Thursday your time, the Global Passive House Showcase will feature Alex Botzel and Laura Squillace from Green Hammer. Green Hammer is a really highly respected design build firm in Portland, Oregon. And they're going to be presenting about the New Day School, which is a zero net energy school retrofit in Portland, Oregon, that uses all sorts of tools from the passive house design and construction palette to reach zero net energy.
Awesome.
Yeah. So that'll be great. And then on Thursday, we have our first ever Building Performance Interactive. So episode one of the new show, the Building Performance Interactive. This is a mini series. It'll be an 8-part mini series. And it's based out of the UK and Ireland. And the first episode will feature special guest Tomas O'Leary and a really great video of on-site video of decarbonization work going on. And this is a show that has been crafted by Hugh Wariski and Yulia Potor of Partel. Hugh will be one of the co-hosts, he'll be joined by Mike Jacobs of Kiss House and Ben Adam Smith of House Planning Help. Sorry. So it's really exciting.
And both previous guests on the show.
That's right. That's right. So it's going to be on Thursday at 2:00 British summertime. And I can't wait.
Awesome. So much going on.
Indeed.
And we do have to remind people that unfortunately the South Pacific Passive House Conference has been delayed at this stage, postponed. Unfortunately, we are in a lockdown currently here in Auckland, and mass gatherings are out of the question. So that was intended to be an in-person event. So it's just been postponed. So check out the passivehouse.nz website for more information on that coming soon. All right. Well, is that a wrap for this week, Zach?
I think so. Thanks again, Matthew, for the fantastic interview with Diana. It was really, really awesome. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Don't forget, you can email us at podcast@passivehouseaccelerator.com. And we look forward to being back again next week on the Passive House Podcast.